headlines ahead of Iran's Atomic Energy Organization says Tehran will keep the UN nuclear agency's cameras turned off until the 2015 nuclear deal is revived. Russia says its recent missile strike on Ukraine's southern port city of Odessa has destroyed a warship and weapons supplied by the United States to Kiev. And Tunisians cast their ballots for a new constitution seen as a referendum on President Kais Saied's policies. Opposition parties have called for a boycott. Hello and welcome. Your world news coming to you live from our headquarters in Tehran. My name is Gisum Shahmadi. Iran says a nuclear agency's cameras installed as part of the JCPOA will remain turned off until the 2015 deal is restored. The head of Iran's Atomic Energy Organization says the cameras were installed to dispel Western accusations against the country's nuclear program. Mohammad Islami stressed that if those accusations are to persist, then there is no reason for the existence of the cameras. He also criticized the recent remarks by the Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency about Iran's nuclear activities. Islami said Iran's objectives in enriching uranium to 60% purity are recorded on paper, and the country started the process under the supervision of the IAEA itself. Rafael Grossi had claimed that no country that does not have, quote, warlike projects enriches uranium at 60% purity level. Masoud Shajari, chairman of the Islamic Human Rights Commission in London, is joining us right now to tell us more about this. What is your take on the remarks by Rafael Grossi claiming that only countries who are seeking nuclear energy for malicious, actually, issues would enrich uranium to 60%. How true is that?
Well, it's not true to start with. I mean, the fact of the matter is Iran is within its right and to have any sort of nuclear activity as long as sort of as is promised is not for sort of creating an atomic bomb and using weaponizing it. The fact of the matter is that the agreement in 2015 has been undermined almost immediately after it was reached, and West has failed dismally to uphold its commitment. There's been no benefit for Iran, and there's been sanctions after sanctions, and as and the articulation from the United States and the West is maximum pressure, while Iran has implemented its side of the deal more or less. The reality is that if we are going to go back to the deal in 2015, and then there has to be incentive. Unfortunately, I think the West has got no incentive because they already are visually sort of controlling all the centers. Iran has implemented its part in the agreement, and even the increase to 60% has been announced and they've been upfront about it and it's been investigated, it's been visually monitored. So really the West hasn't got any incentive to sort of go back to the deal because they're quite comfortable that from what they see Iran is not involved in using weaponizing the deal. So the reality is that I think it is only right to say that if Iran is not going to benefit from economically and from removal of the sanction, then the West should not be in a position to actually expect the part of Iran to be fulfilled by the Iranian. And I just hope that we will see the end of this tit for tat, and the United States and the West will decide to uphold its commitment, so Iran could go back to its commitment also. But I think what is very obvious is that commitment cannot be one-sided.
Thank you very much, Mr. Masoud Shajari, chairman of the Islamic Human Rights Commission, joining us from London. Moving on, Palestinians in the blockaded Gaza Strip held a sit-in to show solidarity with thousands of Palestinian inmates held in Israeli prisons, especially those who are on hunger strike. Palestinians in the coastal enclave say they are planning several events in the coming days to support the prisoners and draw attention to their plight, Ashraf Shannon reports.
Cross office in the blockaded Gaza Strip on Monday in solidarity with Palestinian prisoners on hunger strike. On Sunday, scores of Palestinian prisoners started a mass hunger strike to support two of their fellow prisoners who have been on hunger strike for several months to protest their administrative detention. Around 500 Palestinian prisoners are being held without charge or trial under the so-called administrative detention, while their incarceration periods can be renewed indefinitely. Some prisoners have been held in administrative detention for more than 10 years. Their only recourse to draw attention to their plight has been hunger strikes. Among them, Khalil Awaude has been refusing food since March, and Raed Rayan has adopted the same passive resistance approach since April.
Yesterday, dozens of Palestinian detainees from different factions entered an open-ended hunger strike in solidarity with two Palestinian detainees who are going on their long hunger strike protesting the administrative detention, Khalil Awaude and Raed Rayan.
Currently, some 5,000 Palestinian prisoners are held in 24 Israeli prisons and detention centers. Families of Palestinian prisoners have slammed the silence of the international community over the plight of their loved ones.
I want to talk about the silence of the international community and the United Nations. I sent many letters about my son's case to all of them to intervene with the Israeli government to talk with them about my son's case, but unfortunately no response from all of them.
Prisoners' advocacy groups also condemned Israel's treatment of the Palestinian prisoners, who are subjected to inhumane and degrading conditions, including solitary confinement and bans on family visits.
Palestinian detainees nowadays are subjected to inhumane practices by Israeli prison services. Therefore, we are here today to convey a message to the international community, especially to the ICRC, to put pressure on the Israeli government to stop such policies and to end the Palestinian suffering, Palestinian detainees suffering.
Many here believe that the support Israel enjoys from some countries like the United States gives it the green light to act in contradiction with international law regarding the treatment of prisoners.
Statistics show that the Israeli regime has arrested around 1 million Palestinians since 1967, including women and minors. Among them, some 50,000 administrative detainees. Ashraf Shannon, Gaza.
Moving on, Russia's foreign minister says Western-supplied weapons were destroyed in a strike on the southern Ukrainian port city of Odessa on Saturday. Sergei Lavrov's comments come a day after Moscow said the attack hit a Ukrainian warship and a depot of anti-ship missiles. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky earlier said the attack showed Russia failed to keep its promise as part of a UN-brokered grain deal. Odessa is a key Black Sea terminal for the export of Ukrainian grain. The attack came less than 24 hours after Russia and Ukraine agreed with the United Nations and Turkey on reopening the Black Sea ports for grain exports. Kiev has already confirmed that the Russian strikes left the grain depots in the port intact. Russia began its special military operation in neighboring Ukraine in February. However, Moscow's military goals now go beyond the eastern Donbas region, where Russia initially said it wanted to protect the local population. Russia says its new objective is to overthrow the government in Ukraine.
Russia says it might go beyond Donbas, where it once laid the lines of the conflict in Ukraine. The shift was articulated by Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, who said one reason Russia might expand its operation are the longer-range rockets and artillery the US and NATO allies have been funneling to Ukraine.
The geography is different now. It is not only about the DNR and the LNR, but also about the Kherson region, the Zaporizhia region, and a number of other territories. And this process is continuing, consistently and persistently.
Lavrov's remarks are the clearest comments that Russia's objectives have expanded over the 5 months of war. Earlier, U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin said Lavrov's statement confirmed what Washington and its allies had suspected were Russian President Vladimir Putin's objectives all along.
He has stated a number of times that, you know, this is a limited operation focused on the Donbas. His actions have proven otherwise.
The U.S., despite claiming that it knew about Russia's intentions, only seems to be further fueling the war through its support for Kiev. The U.S.'s military assistance has topped $8 billion U.S. dollars, part of a $40 billion aid package. And all this while analysts view diplomacy as the only tangible solution to the ongoing conflict.
The U.S. Emperor's strategic aim is to expand NATO eastwards, right up to the borders of the Russian Federation, stage coups where necessary, as in Ukraine in 2014. And in the words of Canada's Deputy Prime Minister, Chrystia Freeland, to vanquish Russia, divide it up and gobble up its component parts, the better to march on to China. It's a hegemonic agenda, and there is no way that the U.S. will tolerate the Ukrainian government having a negotiated peace with Russia. Rather, the plan is that to drag the Russian Federation into a long war.
Washington claims to be supporting Ukraine to defend itself. Officials in Kiev have, however, suggested that Crimea, which the West still recognizes as part of Ukraine, could be a target for U.S.-made missiles recently deployed by Kiev. The remark, however, prompted a fierce response from the former Russian president, warning that an attack on Crimea will ignite a Judgment Day response.
Shortly after Russia began its campaign in Ukraine, Western countries rolled out economic sanctions against Moscow, but now European leaders seem to be rethinking their decisions as those policies have backfired on their own economies.
The West, led by the U.S., apart from supplying financial aid, has also imposed a wide range of unprecedented sanctions against Moscow in support for Kiev. The bans have targeted individuals, banks, businesses, and state-owned enterprises, including the oil and gas sector.
The U.S. also planned an economic war on Russia by leveling economic sanctions, which are unilateral and illegal, by excluding Russia from the SWIFT transfer system, by stealing its monetary resources stored in Western banks, and by cutting it off from its natural trading partners in Europe.
The economic impact of the war and the sanctions on Russia is showing across the world. Inflation is up in many countries, global supply chains have been disrupted, and there are fears of food shortages. But now, experts fear the situation, especially in Europe, could further deteriorate as the continent struggles to find middle grounds on solutions to the current uncertainties.
But the U.S. sanctions backfired on the West, especially on Europe, where Europe took the brunt of the energy cutbacks. And it caused the U.S. war caused an inflationary crisis for the entire world.
All this has also led to indications of fatigue settling in the EU. The Hungarian Prime Minister has so far been the most vocal about his concerns regarding the bloc strategies on Ukraine.
West's strategy on Ukraine has failed as governments in Europe are collapsing like dominoes. Energy prices have surged. A new strategy is needed, which should focus on peace talks and drafting a good peace proposal instead of winning the war.
But despite the heavy costs incurred by Europeans, the bloc's leaders seem to have set their eyes on continuing their way. While standards of living in many countries have already deteriorated drastically in light of decisions made by policymakers, problems may further worsen in the future. The International Energy Agency has even warned that a potentially disastrous natural gas supply crunch this winter awaits Europe, mainly due to the possibility of Russia cutting off gas supplies completely.
Tunisians head to the polls to vote on a new constitution drafted by President Kais Saied, that is, as a referendum on its policies. Over 9 million out of Tunisia's 12 million population have registered to vote, and eyes are on the turnout. Opposition groups have called for a boycott on the referendum. They are warning that a largely expected yes vote will give Saied absolute power, risking Tunisia's hard-won democracy. 1 year ago, Saied took full executive power after sacking the government and dismissing the parliament. He pledged to hold a referendum to end what he called the political deadlock in the North African country and its economic woes. He has achieved little during his one-year rule. And now with that, we come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Palestinian Islamic Resistance Movement Hamas has strongly denounced new Israeli plans to build more settlements in the occupied Palestinian lands, stressing that such criminal policies were a direct result of the United States' unconditional support for the Tel Aviv regime. We now present you an article written by Sahar Salhi under the heading, "Every House Belongs to Its Owner and Will Eventually Return to Its Owner." News has circulated about the Zionist regime's new prime minister, Yair Lapid, staying in the occupied villa of a Palestinian businessman from the city of Al-Quds. Yair Lapid's wife also published a picture on social media networks after moving to the new residence, although it is said that this is a temporary stay and will be until the completion of the renovation of her official residence on Balfour Street. In early July, Yair Lapid, the then interim prime minister of the occupying regime, and his wife Lihi moved to an old and beautiful house in Al-Quds called Hana Salame Villa, which abandoned by its owners during the Nakba Day, a move that shows his view of the conflict between Palestinians and Israelis and the violation of the rights of Palestinians, especially their right to return to their homeland. Nakba Day is the name that Palestinians have given to the massacre and forced expulsion of their people by the Zionist regime in 1948, during which they were forced to leave their homes. Salama Villa, which is located on Balfour Street, Talbiya neighborhood, is one of the beautiful villas that was constructed in the 1930s in Palestine with Art Deco style. There is still a sign in three languages at the entrance and in front of the building, which shows the history of the building construction in 1932, and the name of the designer and architect, Zoltán Hamet. Zoltán Hamet was originally a Jewish-Hungarian architect who went to Palestine and started working there a year after graduating from the Faculty of Architecture at Budapest University in Hungary. Owner of this villa, Hana Salame, was an Arab Christian merchant who owned the General Motors dealership in Jordan and in Palestine before the Nakba and built it in the western part of the city of Al-Quds in 1932. After the Nakba and the occupation and bombing of Palestinian neighborhoods in the western areas of Al-Quds, especially the neighborhood of Katamon and Talbiya, Hana Salama left her villa and became a refugee in Beirut, and the occupying Israeli regime seized the villa by force under the absentee's property law. The law allows the theft of the property of Palestinian refugees and gives the property since the time of its confiscation to Israelis, who are called the guardian of absentee's property. The absentee's property law also allows the Israeli occupation regime to confiscate Palestinian assets, including cash, stocks, furniture, books, companies, banks, and other alienable assets. The main owners of these properties are mostly refugees from other countries, but some of them are internally displaced and now live in their occupied Palestinian lands. After the villa was subjected to usurpation law, it was occupied and taken over and was used by the occupying regime and leased out to foreign countries. For a while, the villa was used to accommodate Israeli soldiers and marines, and for some time it was the residence of the guards and bodyguards of the US consulate on Agron Street, next to the endowments and the Ma'aman Allah Cemetery. After that, the Guatemalan embassy was located there until 1980, when it left after the approval of the United Al-Quds law by the occupying regime. Then the villa was sold on to an Israeli businessman who added three floors to the building of the villa to to convert it into several apartments for rent. And later again, for many years, this building was used for the residence of the guards and security services of the official residence of the occupying regime's Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, which is located on Balfour Street near this villa. Two former Israeli prime ministers, David Ben-Gurion and Levi Eshkol, refused to live in Palestinian properties seized under the absentees' property law, making Yair Lapid's decision an oddity in Israeli politics. David Ben-Gurion, the commander of the Haganah gang, who committed ethnic cleansing crimes in Palestine, including the shelling of Palestinian homes in the western neighborhoods of Al-Quds during his premiership, refused to move to live in the very Hana Salama villa in his presidency. Yair Lapid is considered to be the first prime minister of the Zionist regime to have made this decision, which reveals the black truth about his positions regarding the right of return of the Palestinians and the future of Al-Quds, and clearly shows that he's against this right. Jihad Abu Raya, Palestinian researcher and lawyer in Haifa, says, Yair Lapid's decision is reminiscent of Israel's crimes against Palestinians. After expelling the Palestinians and massacring them in their villages and cities, Israeli regime embarked on seizing their homes, houses, factories, shrines, cemeteries, mosques, etc., and acts not as the guardian of such property, but as a thief and a looter. Recently, the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has strongly denounced new Israeli plans to build more illegal settlements in the occupied Palestinian lands, stressing that such criminal policies were a direct result of United States' unconditional support for the Tel Aviv regime. Hamas said in a recent statement that Israel had endorsed plans to seize large swathes of Palestinian land to build 2,000 new settler units near Beit Safafa town in occupied Al-Quds. The statement said, "The settlement expansion in Al-Quds is a crime that reflects the American support for the occupation's projects and exposes the false claims of peace." Hamas further said that the resumption of Israel's settlement activities came against the backdrop of U.S. President Joe Biden's controversial trip to the occupied Palestinian territories and to West Asia, adding, "The timing of this settlement project after U.S. President Biden's visit to the occupied lands reveals once again the size of support and official cover being provided by the U.S. administration for the enemy in its aggression against our land, our people, and our holy sites." Elsewhere in the statement, Hamas said that Israel's persistence in expanding illegal settlements reflected the dangerous nature of the Zionist project that is based on Judaizing the Palestinian lands and displacing the Palestinian people. It also described the plan as another desperate and failed attempt to impose a demographic fait accompli and target the Palestinian people's rights and identity. Palestinian media recently quoted the head of the Settlement and War Resistance Commission, Muayyad Sha'ban, as revealing that the Israeli authorities had legalized the Mitzpah Dani settlement outpost east of the West Bank city of Ramallah and endorsed the plan to add 114 new settler units to it. He said that the Israeli regime was planning to seize large pieces of land in the village of Deir Dibwan for settlement expansion activities in the area. Muayyad Sha'ban warned that the Israeli authorities were establishing new settlements specifically in the eastern part of the occupied city of Al-Quds in the occupied West Bank, close to the Jordan Valley. recent months, the Zionist regime has been rapidly expanding its illegal settlements in contravention of international laws. On 12th of July, the Norwegian Refugee Council said Israeli authorities had ramped up settlement expansion and demolition activities across the West Bank and Eastern Al-Quds in the first 6 months of the current year. Between 600,000 and 750,000 Israelis live in over 250 illegal settlements built since the 1967 occupation of the Palestinian territories of the West Bank and Eastern Al-Quds. Palestinians want the West Bank as part of a future independent Palestinian state, with Eastern Al-Quds as its capital. The last round of Israeli-Palestinian talks collapsed in 2014, with Israel's continued illegal settlement expansion emerging as a key sticking point.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Alhamdulillahi rabbil alamin. Wassalatu wassalamu ala sayyidina Muhammadin wa ala ahli baytihi at-tayyibin at-tahirin. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing about the topic of the Charter of Islamic Governance based on the teachings of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahjul Balagha. We are currently focusing on the 16th sermon, where Imam Ali alayhi salam explains about the important discussion of his strategy in guiding and reforming the Islamic community. And one of the strategies that Imam Ali alayhi salam mentions was that there will be a filtration process where people will be filtered, where their realities will be discovered and will be recognized. And one of those filters will be the Battle of Jamal, where Imam Ali alayhi salam recognized the people, where people were recognized, where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala saw which of these people are really truthful. Are they going to be fooled by some of the apparent, very respectable people in the apparent sense, like maybe the wife of the Prophet or maybe some great Sahaba? Are they going to be attracted by them in such a way that they will leave the path of the truth, or no, they will keep the truth as the criterion and follow what is correct, even if on the other side there seems to be a very powerful figure, a very respectable and honorable person in the apparent sense? What is the criterion? Imam Ali alayhi salam wanted to revive the idea that truth and the Islamic true principles is the criterion and not some apparent glamour or some apparent position.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to IRIB English Radio. We are talking about those filters that Imam Ali alayhi salam said in his sermon, that you will be certainly filtered and you will be certainly deceived. Imam Ali alayhi salam, we say that the first sieve, the first filter was the filter of the Battle of Jamal, whereby on one side you saw that the wife of the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam comes with a camel, with a whole entourage, and we see what happened. Now comes the Battle of Siffin. In the Battle of Siffin is the other sieve, whereby people had to fight Muawiyah. Muawiyah that, you know, acted like he's a very pious and religious person in the apparent sense, but inherently he was a very impious, world-loving, and very proud person, who killed several important Sahabas, who also committed heinous crimes, who actually reinstated, or rather he is the one who re-established, or we can say he started this bid'ah, and this new system of governance of, you know, whereby people choose their own children as leaders themselves and dictate it to the people, and finally actually bring up a system of kingship and kingdom, which was not there in Islam. And various other crimes that Muawiyah committed, that the Shias and the Sunni scholars both agree on that. This Muawiyah was a very, very shrewd and clever person. So the first sieve was a sieve of not being deceived by apparent position, apparent honor and respect. That was the first sieve. The second sieve again was also of the same type, but this time it is a bit different in the sense that this sieve was not to be deceived by the apparent state of the Quran. So when Muawiyah saw that he was losing the battle and Malik Ashtar was just next to his tent and was going to take over and win the war, Muawiyah takes the Quran and puts it on spears and tells the people that I'm ready for a peace treaty, and I don't know, let the Quran be an arbiter between us. And therefore the people got confused by this apparent trick. That means the people did not have that insight to see that these apparent verses of the Quran, these apparent, you know, parchments of the Quran, is not the actual thing that is going to bring about salvation, but it is acting according to the true teachings of the Quran from Imam Ali alayhi salam that would actually lead to our salvation. But unfortunately, a few people did not have that understanding and they were sieved out in the process. This was the second sieve.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to IRIB English Radio. We are talking about these various filters that were there for the Islamic Ummah. The second filter was the filter of the Battle of Siffin, where you can say this was where Muawiyah was cheating the people with that apparent strength and glamour and that apparent, you know, show of Islam that he had. And when he raised the Quran on the spears, he knew that he doesn't actually believe in this Quran, but he had no choice but to raise that on the spear so that Imam Ali doesn't advance towards them. And this trick of Muawiyah, this scheme of Muawiyah was successful. And some of the feeble-minded people in Imam Ali alayhi salam's army, they even went against Imam Ali alayhi salam. So this was the second filter, whereby a large group of people, unfortunately, they deflected from the army of Imam Ali alayhi salam, and they forced Imam Ali alayhi salam to succumb to a certain arbitration system that was very unfair. And of course, it came up to the loss of the Muslims and to the army of Imam Ali alayhi salam, while Imam Ali alayhi salam was just two steps away from winning the war. Well, this was another sieve, as I said, another filtration process, whereby Imam Ali alayhi salam wanted to show the people that, see, the water of Islam is dirty. The water is made up of people. The water of the Muslim Ummah is made up of people who are just, whose minds are so stagnant that they just look at the apparent things and they don't have even that insight to see the internal intricacies of the events that are happening. Inshallah, we'll discuss about the third sieve in the third filter in the coming session. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
بالكتاب مسدد والنور معنا باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من نداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال منه هو في الشدائد منجد والفضل يمنى هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي ربا.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains, close up, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company.
it's really hot in here. And eating ice cream really hits the spot. Fortunately, I have ice cream in the freezer. Yes. Today, there are different brands of ice creams in the world, which have chain stores in most of the countries, and almost everyone is familiar with their name. It's interesting to know that we, in Iran, have a well-known traditional ice cream name, namely Akbarmashti ice cream. The delicious ice cream which I'm eating right now is from this brand. It tastes great. This ice cream dates back to nearly 80 years ago. Today we are going to visit Akbarmashti ice cream shop. Stay with me. Akbarmashti was the first Iranian who started the business of selling ice cream. His real name was Akbar Jafari Malayeri. He tried several different professions before starting an ice cream shop. At those times, he met a person who had learned about making ice cream in France. Akbarmashti, along with that man, opened the first ice cream shop in Tehran at Ray Street. The ice cream produced in this shop was completely compatible with the Iranian taste. He used clotted cream, rose water, and saffron for making this particular type of ice cream. In those days that refrigerator was not widely used, people used to dig deep holes in the earth, then poured ice gained from mountains in these holes and covered them. In the time of need to the ice, in the hot seasons, they took ice from the holes. Akbarmashti used to keep his ice cream cold in proximity of the ice which was gained in this way. Akbarmashti died at 97. His stepson, called Mohammad Malayeri, inherited his ice cream shop, who, by launching another branch of Akbarmashti ice cream shop at Tajrish Square in Tehran, has enlivened the name of this old Iranian ice cream brand. I am now at Tajrish Square, an old neighborhood located in northern Tehran. People are standing in a queue to buy ice cream. Of course, Akbarmashti ice cream. I'll stand in the queue in order to buy some ice cream. Then I'll talk to you about the vibes of this well-known ice cream shop. I am now inside Akbarmashti ice cream shop. The kind owner of this shop, Mr. Mohammad Malayeri, gave me the permission to take a close look at the corners of this shop. Well, there are pieces of old newspapers and magazines on the walls. These papers have published interesting information about this ice cream shop. This part of the shop is an attractive location for the customers who have heard about the reputation of Akbarmashti ice cream. On this wall, there is the picture of Mohammad Malayeri, known as Amir Mashti, standing beside Akbarmashti. And this is an amazing picture of Amir Mashti wearing academic dress.
He has majored in law. He told me that one night he had a dream about his uncle, who had advised him to continue the profession of making and selling ice cream and enliven the name of Akbar Mashti. Well, I'll buy some ice cream for myself and a lot more for my grandma, 'cause she loves Akbar Mashti ice cream. And who doesn't like such a delicious, fragrant saffron ice cream? Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
peace, he sent me a peace, so I am lost for sure.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day with Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program Hadith of the Day here at IRIB English Radio. Today on Hadith of the Day, we would like to present a very beautiful and noble hadith narrated from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. This hadith is about the believer's intense love for God. You know, there's many hadiths and there's many verses of the Holy Quran as well, which speak about the love of God. The love of God is one of those very central important and significant Islamic virtues. In fact, some people say that it is the most central Islamic virtue, and it is the virtue that has the ability to eliminate and eradicate all vices and bring the aspirant who desires to ascend spiritually to God to him. Before we get to this hadith from Imam Sadiq, let's look at a verse of the Holy Quran regarding the love of God. In one verse of the Holy Quran, God Almighty says, "Among the people are those who set up compeers besides Allah, loving them as if loving Allah. But the faithful have a more ardent love for Allah, though the wrongdoers will see, when they cite the punishment, that power altogether belongs to Allah, and that Allah is severe in punishment." Regarding the love of Allah, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam has been narrated to have said, "Man's faith in Allah will not be pure until Allah becomes more beloved to him than his own self, his father, his mother, his children, his wife, his wealth, and all people." So this hadith, it talks about the sign for the purity in God's love or the love of Allah. Because obviously there is no person, no human being who doesn't have some sort of love for God. You know, there's a very famous hadith narrated from the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, who said, "Kullu mawludin yuladu ala al-fitra," that there is not a newborn baby that is born except that it is born on the divine nature. And when the Prophet was asked about this, he said it is the belief in God's unity. So intrinsically and essentially, all human beings, they have this intrinsic love for God. Due to the fact that we live in this world and we become preoccupied with the concerns and affairs of the world and everything connected to it, sometimes layers and curtains come upon this love, and to use the terminology in this hadith, it loses its purity. It becomes tainted with the love of the world and the love of things connected to the world. Right. So the Imam says that if we want to know whether a person's love is pure and is untainted and is solely for God, you have to see whether God is more beloved to him than these people that he mentions, himself, his father, his mother, his children, his wife, his wealth, and all other people. Thank you for joining us here on Hadith of the Day.